welcome to Wanda's Chicks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And that was Victoria Theodore's Grateful. And I just thought I'd play that for our guest, Regina Evans, because, my goodness, after you see her play, you're going to be so thankful to be free. Good morning, Regina. Thanks so much for joining us at this early, early hour.
You are welcome. Thank you, Wanda. Thank you.
Yes, it's been a long, long time. We're just reminiscing before we went on the air about how long it's been since we talked, how long since we've seen each other, even longer than how long we've talked. My goodness.
I think it's been like
a couple of years.
Yep, it's been 2 years, yo. It's been 2 years.
Yeah.
And we were meant to meet.
certainly, yeah. I mean, you know, talking about, you know, sexual trafficking, connecting that to, you know, the slave trade historically, and then just sort of bring it at home, you know, folks, you know, think about it like, wow, we have slaves in our urban society, urban, you know, environment.
Oh, yeah.
My goodness, Oakland, California, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Richmond, you know, all over the place, and the victims are so young.
Yes, 5 years old.
Yeah.
7, 10. The stats say the average entry, which I believe they really don't know, but they say the average age of entry is somewhere in between, I think, like 12 to 14 or something like that. So, and that means being, it's very young. But, I mean, we hear a lot of stats, but I personally, and I don't have any, you know, educational background or knowledge on this, but it's just kind of from my gut. I think a lot of this that we just don't know because so much of it is hidden. And so I always, when people are throwing stats out, I'm like, how do we know it's that figure? But, you know, I guess from, like, the girls that they actually, because they do arrest them, so which is another issue, arrest and the ones that are rescued, you know, I guess some of the stats come from that, but they're pretty young. But, I mean, there are victims that are as young as 5 years old. And so that's the problem because then they, you know, they stay trapped in that. And so you're trapped in so many ways in that mentality and just, you know, physically, emotionally, like spiritually, in like every single way. And there are not enough homes for them to go to. And so, I mean, it is a huge issue, just a huge gut-wrenching issue. There's not enough of homes for them to go to where they can heal. I just went to a forum last weekend, and I think they were saying that there's less than 200 beds in the United States, 200 to 300 beds in the United States. And the stat is that there are about 300,000 kids trapped in trafficking in the United States. So that's a huge differential.
That's larger than that's a travesty that there are only 200 to 300 beds for these children. Wow. I mean, yeah, children and adults for that matter.
Goodness.
So what was this forum you went to last week?
There is a project called the Red Windows Project, which is actually started out of IJM, which is the International Justice Mission. And my friend Mark Fisher, who's an abolitionist, he heads it. And some of the proceeds from my play actually go to support Red Windows. So I kind of hang out with them whenever I can. And so he did a just a class to kind of bring about awareness. So he's doing a series of classes. And I know he's doing something at Berkeley First Pres Church this coming Sunday too. So they're just awareness raising efforts to give people knowledge about what's going on. And the Red Windows Project is actually a unique project. They started in the Philippines, and what they do is it's a model where they will go in and. So the women who were rescued out of trafficking, because they have been kidnapped so young, some of them are like at 5 or 8 or whatever, they haven't even finished high school. So they could be like 25 years old now. So what they do is they set them up in high school programs, and they also send them to college. And so that's the model. And I believe that they started it there, but they're also making forays into the U.S. as well to bring that kind of model here into the States. That's my understanding. So I just went to that and kind of learned a bit more. Just a couple of other abolitionists there as well. So, and a lot of new people that I'd never seen, which is good because we need new people in this fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what that was.
Mm-hmm. So how did you happen to start writing plays about...
Oh, wow.
About this population that...
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't even know exists. We have people coming over from other countries,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have their immigration mm-hmm. together, and so they're victimized
mm-hmm.
by the people they might work for or the people that helped them get here, and then they sort of get trapped. I know when our Attorney General for the state of California, Kamala Harris, was in San Francisco, she set up like a task force to really focus on this particular population in our community that don't know that they have rights, and there's a whole it's a part of the FBI, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. But how did you? As I think I remember correctly, because when Assemblyman Sandre Swanson was in Sacramento, he did a whole lot around legislation.
Yes, he did.
Criminalizing mm-hmm. the men
mm-hmm.
and, you know, perhaps even women who victimize these young people, a lot of times young people, who sometimes, you know, they run away from home and they're living on the streets and they
mm-hmm.
don't have any way of making a living. Please talk about how you sort of came into this as an artist.
Well, it's a long, circuitous answer, so let me give you the short version, because it's because journeys are long journeys sometimes. So I was living in Australia, had been living there for a very long time. Prior to that, I had lived in London. And so when I was in London, I actually, because this is part of my past, but I don't know if I told you this whole story. So, but I have talked about it. So part of my past is as, you know, a call girl, whatever you want to call, whatever term you want to put to it. So I don't know what term to put to it because there's so many terms to it. So definitions and names and stuff, but I'll just use that one. And so I was abused and, you know, the whole thing. I was older, though. You know, I wasn't 5, so... It was just horrible. It just kind of spiraled out of control. So got my life back on track. You know, I was in Australia. I started a business. I was doing really well, was healing, you know, and I had a group of women who had found out, I still don't know, but people will do this. This is what they do. And tried to out my past because I had kept it hidden, which is why I don't keep it hidden now, because I pour my own cup of tea. And so my business was very successful. And it was just horrible. Like, they threatened to go to the media. The media was getting ready to do this, like, big expose on me because my business was, in Australia, was really huge. I was, like, always in the media. And I just put it shortly. Basically, I believe God intervened and all of that stopped. But they harassed and bullied me for one whole year. And it affected my business. And I ended up shutting my business down. But I was going through a lot of stuff. My father was dying. But that was actually part of me shutting my business down as well. But I was going through some other things, and I came home. And in the course of my shutting my business down, coming home, I actually ended up giving everything away. I was like on this huge spiritual journey. I was like, I can start over. I felt like I should feed into other people's lives. So I gave my stock away to my friends, some students that I was teaching in Australia. I came home and I actually went homeless because I had given everything away. I came home with no money. So I went homeless. I kind of fell out with my family a little bit because they were like, what are you doing? You were just like dressing, you know, Kate Blanchett, and Beyonce was one of your customers, and now you have nothing. And so I think it was kind of too much. And I was just miserable. And so in the course of being miserable, I was like, well, there's got to be like something that I can do to lift me out of my misery and to help other people. And I was actually also going to a church, and there was a woman who was like, you should get involved with this issue, and not knowing anything about my past. And I was like, huh. And so I started kind of researching about it, and then I found someone came up to me and said they need a creative writing teacher at this youth shelter called Dreamcatchers. And there's this amazing young woman there named Sarai Theolinda Smith, who is awesome, just amazing. And she was one of the people that helped start Missy with Nola Brantley. And you know, Missy does a lot of work, really, really amazing and important work in the Bay Area with young sex trafficked victims. And so anyway, so I went there and I did a kind of a creative writing course for these runaway and homeless youth. And so I was blessed that, you know, they let me do that. And so I started getting angry, and I was really pissed off. I didn't have any money. I probably had about $10 a day. I decided to do a play and was still kind of couch surfing, didn't have a home. And I was like, God, how am I going to do it? And I was working at, by that time I was working at the theater where I actually met you. And they were paying me like $500 every 3 months. So, you know, still like really poor.
Every 3 months? Oh,
every 3 months. But I said, okay, God, I'm going to write this play. 2 days later, Jan, the owner, said, can you do the house? Can you be the house manager? I was like, yes. She was like, okay, I'm going to give you the keys to the office because I had to work on the computer. I was like, oh, my God, that's how I'm going to write my play. So I'd work on the computer. I had the keys, so I would actually stay and write my play from, like, 12 midnight until, like, 5, 6 in the morning. And that's how I wrote it. And I wrote my first play that way, like, with nothing. In the middle of the night, waking up, sleeping on the floor of that theater. In the theater office. And I would get up and leave, and I would go to the Berkeley Public Library, and that's how I wrote it. And then I had a friend up in Sacramento. I couch surfed up there with them, and they are involved with sex trafficking as well, as abolitionists, and I stayed with them for a little while. But that's how I wrote it, like literally, and people don't know the backstory. They don't know what I went through. I actually had a minor stroke. It was crazy.
Oh.
Yeah, I did. It was hard because if you writing a play, because not only did I write it, I directed it and I produced it and I had nothing. I was homeless. Doing all that like just regular is hard. Doing it homeless is and couch surfing is crazy. But I was so passionate, and I was so pissed off. So that's how I know it's a long story, but that's the truth of, like, of everything. And so I put a lot of my own feelings of my own healing and stuff into my poetry. And so then I did that. The theater that I was working for actually gave me the theater for 2 weeks. And for free, and they came alongside me and did all the tech work. We sold out every night, and so it went really well. And then I had it in San Francisco, and it fell apart. I was like, wow, that's crazy. And so I tried to get it back up again, and it just fell apart. And so I just switched gears, and I created a new play, and I did it as a one-woman show, and it still has the same fire. It is fiery. It is so fiery. It's like, because I'm pissed. It's just like fire. I performed it on Sunday at a church, at a Chinese church, and I mean, it was like fire. And people were weeping, and I'm weeping on stage because I can't deal with that weeping. So I'm like, I'm just going to write weeping in. So, but it's like fire. Like, I really accost the audience for their inactivity and in helping these kids. And so, and every time I do it, yeah, it's an angry, kind of bitter almost. And like mournful. It's mournful. That's what I would describe it. So luckily I got into Diva Fest in San Francisco, which is amazing. And so I'm so thankful for them, because I actually am a part of before that I did Divas Tell All. And Divas Tell All is almost like an incubator for women who have new works. And so I was able to perform, and it's at the exit stage. It's a series, and it's curated by Catherine Debol. She's from France, and so that's kind of how I got my start in the theater in San Francisco. And so from there, they invited me to Diva Fest, so I performed this Saturday at 8 with two other people, and then I got into the San Francisco Fringe Festival. So that's in September. So it's good because it's getting
Jesus.
The...
Oh, so you're going to come back with it. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's good because then you get, like, more people involved in this fight, you know. And so that was my... That's why I did it, because I said, look, theater has such a huge voice. And so, you know, but, yeah, so that's, like, that's such a long story, but that's, like, the short version of the story, but that's how I got involved with it. So... passion, so my own background, just passion, and you know, a lot of fight. So it's been a huge fight. So, but I also had the White House call me to say thank you for writing Echo, which was my first play, which was crazy. Yep, they sure did.
Wow.
I walked in. I know they walked. I walked into my mom's house, and she said, very calmly, the White House called. I was like, oh, my God, what did I do now? You know, no, I'm just kidding. I was like, why? Yeah. She was like, they called to thank you for writing. And I needed it, because at that point, I that week, I had decided to give up. I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. I can't get anybody to help me. Nobody cares about me. Nobody cares about these kids, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that week, the White House called. So...
wow.
I was like, okay,
perfect,
I'm going to...
Perfect timing, huh?
Yeah. So that's the whole story, Wanda. So, and in the course of all that, somewhere I met you when I was working at that theater, and we connected
right.
up. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that is so amazing. Yeah, and
You're
also the author of poetry books, Noni and The Butterfly, Unlatched, Mosaic, and Nothing Cool About Ten. And in this play, your full-length play that you're talking about, Echo, A Poetic Journey into Justice. So I was wondering if you could maybe share a little bit of your play with us. And I also want to let folks know that you're going to be performing, we mentioned more than once that you're performing on June 1st as a part of Divas Tell All with two other playwrights, and this is a second part of Divas Tell All, curated by Catherine Debol. The first was May 18th, and we actually had Mia Pascal on talking about her play, and it was also performed at Tell It On Tuesdays in the East Bay this past Tuesday. And this is going to be performed, Divas Tell All, at the Exit Studio. And I was looking for the address. Is this the one, the Exit on Taylor? Is it that the one?
Eddie.
That was the one with Eddie? Okay. Okay. Do you have the address?
Let me see.
If not, I can look it up.
I think it's one. I don't have it in front of me. I think it's 176 Eddy.
Okay, I'll look it up and confirm that.
I think that's what it is.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure.
Okay. All right. Do you want to share something from, yeah, because you said you have these different, you have your play, you have different, so you've had, you have a time, like you have a really short one, you have like 30 minutes. I was interested, just tell our audience how you've broken down your work to sort of fit any situation, which is, which sounds really great. Like,
yep, I wrote it so that it could fit into, like, if a group wanted me to come and, because my whole thing is, like, awareness and action. So, I mean, I'm creative and theatrical and all that, but to me, I the basis of everything that I do is to get, is towards awareness and action. So I wanted to be able, I wanted it to be movable so that it could fit into people's schedules, because I know people are busy, you know, and not everybody has theater lighting, and so I wrote it, and I broke it down so that it would be effective. So I have a, the two-minute thing that I do is, a, which I can do, is it's a poem called Somebody's Baby, Somebody's Child. So I just do that, and then I do like a, I think it's like a 10, 20, 30 and 50 minutes. Like the one on Saturday is going to be the 30-minute piece. And so, because basically it's three girls, and it kind of tells their story from beginning to end. And so I just kind of broke it. Am I going to do like one, two, three, or am I going to take like this really powerful one poem? And so that's how I do it. Do I tell the story one girl, two girls, or three girls? And, like, the one on Saturday is going to be the story of two girls. And I also wrote it so that it doesn't need any it doesn't need any props, it doesn't need any lighting, and it doesn't need any sound. But I did write all of that in case I'm able to have it all. Because I had a trainer. This is how I came up with the idea. I had a trainer about 20 years ago, and like a gym trainer. And he said to me, I'm going to teach you how to... You know, he have all the machines and all the fancy equipment and everything. He took me to an old gym, and he said, I'm going to teach you how to use this old equipment, and I'm also going to teach you how to do everything that I've taught you, like in the new fancy place and in this old gym. I'm going to teach you how to do this without, to get the same results without any machines. Because if you're traveling or whatever, then you could still do what you need to do to get the same result. And for some reason, that always stuck in my head, like 20 years later. So I thought of that when I was writing this play. So I still want the same results. I still want people to be aware of trafficking, that kids are being brutalized. You know, that kids are being snatched from their schools, from their homes, and then nobody is rescuing them. And that people need to do something about it. I still want that out there. And so that's why I wrote it with you know, not a lot of stuff around it. The power is in the words. So that's how I came up with the concept. So.
Yeah, it sounds real self-sufficient and also really portable.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they could go anywhere.
So you're never, so you're never stuck. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Mm-hmm.
Before you share something, how many characters are there, and are they composites?
There are basically three, and it's more, I don't know really how to explain it, because sometimes I go into character, sometimes I just, but a lot of it I just tell their story, because I reference. Not that I'm a comedian or anything, but I reference Whoopi Goldberg a lot. How she's a storyteller, but she'll go into character. But I don't. Mm-hmm. But there are times where she just tells a story, and I come from like a line of storytellers on my dad's side, and so I'll tell their story, but I do like go into character with them. Very little, actually, but there is a pimp in there, and I go into character but I engage the audience. So that's kind of like a little bit like unsettling for the audience. So, because I talk to the audience like I'm the pimp, but I choose one audience member, and that's like unsettling for the person. Yeah.
Wow.
Because I'm in their face. A lot of this is not, because when I was writing it, and when I, all I could think of was take down the fourth wall, you know, the thing between the audience and the players on stage. There's like this invisible wall. And I was like, I've got to take it down. I don't want it to be there. Because it's kind of the same thing that's between the populace and these kids. It's something, it feels like there's something there where people don't help them. And so I wanted to kind of bust through that and reach through it and pull the audience into the world of these kids. And so I'm in their face. I'm in the audience face. Even when I'm not close to them, because I do come out from the stage and stand right in their face, like literally. But even when I'm not doing, and even when I'm not doing that, I'm kind of still in their face and stuff, because it's almost like a screaming. It's almost like a child screaming, "Help me, you know, help me." And so, if you can imagine the frustration of having to go through all of that as a child, to go through being raped, like every day, to go through being beaten and you're screaming and no one hears you and no one sees you, there's a frustration in that. And so I wanted to bring that to the audience, like up close and personal. So that's how I wrote it, designed that way.
Yeah, because you have your longer piece is, you titled it 52 Letters. And is that the one you're going to perform again this September?
Yes, the piece now that I'm performing is called 52 Letters.
Oh, it is called 52 Letters. Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, my first one was called Echo, A Poetic Journey into Justice, and this play now is called 52 Letters.
Okay, because it doesn't have a title in the
Divas Tell-All.
It has a title for the Fringe Festival.
Because I hadn't, I hadn't named it then. I named it that night that I did the piece. It was just like an untitled piece. But I named it from a reference out of the Book of Nehemiah, where it says, and they built the wall in 52 days. So it's like almost becoming a fortress. It's like, you know, that's all I could see is like building a, being, having these, like protecting, like protecting these kids, like, you know, having protection. And so it's like, so I said 52 letters. Because for me, because I believe that there's a lot of power in words and being able to lift people up into action. And so your words and your letters can actually do that if you, you know, if you're effective about it. And so that can then bring about a human fortress for people, for these kids. So that's how I came up with the title. It kind of doesn't make, because you're like looking at the play, you're like, where does the 52 letters come in? It's like, well, that's the title of it. That's how I came up with it. It's like a fortress. And they built the wall in 52 days. I took it from that scripture. It's like, you are protected. I want these kids to be protected. So that's it.
Yeah. It's really nice the way you have these stuffed dolls as the image. Next 52 letters, the little black raggedy Ann dolls. It's really nice. Yeah, so I want to let audience members know that besides seeing the excerpt this Saturday, June 1st, at the Exit Theater on Eddy, you can also see the longer full-length piece, 45 to 50 minutes, during the San Francisco Fringe Festival 2013, September 6th through 21st. And Regina actually has four performances. She's got one on Saturday the 7th at 4 p.m., Friday, September 13th at 9, Tuesday, September 17th at 9, and Saturday, September 21st at 2:30. So you have an opportunity to see it more than once. However, for Diva Fest, which is like the warm-up, mm-hmm. It's an opportunity for female artists to show their work in progress and for audiences to give their support and feedback. So, and then this tell-all events are actually going to be happening once every 2 months and leading up to the Fringe, I suppose, but I think everybody's sort of connected there. So,
right.
So anyway,
right.
Yeah. Right. So this this performance is June 1st at 8 o'clock at the Exit Studio. So what are you going to share with us?
Okay, so I'm going to, this is my piece called I'm Somebody's Baby, I'm Somebody's Child. And I think it's a call to action piece. I do this piece a lot around wherever, you know, if people are like, you have like 1 minute, you have 2 minutes. So I do this piece. This is a piece to get people awakened to what these kids and youth and women, I'll say, are going through, and men actually are going through, and in terms of trafficking, and to awaken their hearts, to awaken their minds, and then to get them actually to do something. So that's the piece. So I'll just start it. I'm somebody's baby. I'm somebody's child. And it's past time for you to lay your life upon the ark of justice. For your notes of mercy to float forth from your throat on my behalf. I am somebody's baby. I'm somebody's child. And I want you to speak to the dead places where care and compassion are supposed to reside, and breathe life into their bones and raise up a mighty army of love for me. I'm somebody's baby. I'm somebody's child. Can you not see that I'm drowning in the brutalizing place of fear? Do your ears not perceive the tears that drip from my heart, yearning to be released from the clutches of hell that have become my prison? Can you not smell the loss of hope that pervades my world from being shoved into a corner of specialized care? And let me tell you something. You listen. I'm somebody's baby. I'm somebody's child. And it's cold out here, standing in fear, trembling in unbelief, having to feel and to smell filth. Don't I have a right to live, to life? I'm somebody's baby. I'm somebody's child. And I want you to look me in my eyes and speak to me that I am not worthy to have the warmth of your being wrap itself across my lonely soul. Tell me that I am not lovely enough for you to risk your life for me. I'm somebody's baby. I'm somebody's child. Do you not think about what my days look like, what the hours or the seconds or the minutes bring, that I don't truly know what a blue sky looks like because the lenses of my eyes have been painted over with the sweat of a multitude who breathe death into my spirit, that I can't remember how the beautiful touch of love should resonate through my being? Oh, how it should kiss my brow, because my soul has been cracked into tiny shards of brittle brokenness, and every day, I am torn by an endless stream of hate, and it takes me over. So listen, won't you hear my cry today? And won't you hug the rivers that leak from my eyes and taste my tears? I'm somebody's baby. I'm somebody's child. And I am yours to love. Yours. Ta-da, and that's it. That's the end of it.
Oh, my goodness. I think I will sit in the back of the theater. Like, oh, my gosh. Oh,
yeah.
Man, I see how everybody was weeping in the church this past weekend. Oh, my goodness.
I know. It's
wow.
Weird because I wrote that piece in about maybe 2 to 5 minutes, as fast as I could say it. And it just came out of me one day. I was sitting and I went whoosh, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is a really weird piece. It's grammatically incorrect. So I showed it to a friend and I said, do you, my friend used to be a pastor at this church I go to, John O'Hara. He actually helped me with my first play, he and his wife. And I said, do you think I need to change this? It's like all grammatically incorrect and stuff. He looked at me, he said, do you think you need to change it? And so I was like, nope. And that was it. It just came right out of my belly. And so I put it in this play. So it wasn't my first play. There was, remember I told you I kept a couple of pieces? That was one that I kept. So, yeah. And that one I do right in front. I do that one right in front of the audience. But I've done it back east. I've done it, like, and I guess the same response. So I think it's a good piece to get people moving and to feel what, you know, these kids feel. You know, so, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's one
so,
that's, you know, in there.
Yeah. Are you, you talked about how you were homeless and, how you're working, but you weren't making a lot of money, and how much this works, you know, as an abolitionist, and also, you know, a woman who is you know, now free, you know, who, you know, actually you were a victim as well. Just for our audience, are you okay now? Economically, you're fine. You have home, housing.
Yeah, because the thing is, the weird thing is that when those women outed me in Australia, which was a horrible thing to do, but it happens. It happens. I've read there's so many cases where people, you know, because people will have paths and they, you know, and they'll go on with their lives. And for some reason, like in our society, you know, people find out and they're like, oh, boom. And it tears their life apart. And, but it ended up being a blessing because then I dealt with it. And I had to go back into my childhood and deal with a lot of stuff that happened then that I had never dealt with. And so, but it's been such a long time since, you know, all that stuff happened, but the wounds were still there. And so while they kind of ripped open my wounds, I guess it just had to be done, you know. And so I took a lot of time to heal. And when I write, you know, I heal. But I went through a lot. I mean, I went through a lot. And I don't actually talk a lot about the things that I went through. You know, I'm kind of an enigma. People can't figure me out. But, you know, I'm passionate about what I do. Like I'll just tell people bits and pieces and stuff. But, and I have told, like, my whole story. And stuff, so because I believe that you should, one way that you keep your power is that you pour your own cup of tea. I heard Bishop Flinders from over in San Francisco say that one day. You know, Bishop Yvette Flinders?
Oh, yeah.
Man, she is awesome. I heard her say that. She's like, pour your own cup of tea. I was like, pour your own cup of tea! You know, so I was like, oh my gosh. Because people can be cruel, and they think they have something over you. And that was part of my healing process, is like speaking out my truth. And so once I did that and began to heal, and I was like, huh, this is really good. And then I could use it for other people and stuff. And so I'm fine now. I'm working. Because when I came home, I was just like, it was such a bad time economically. And so I just couldn't get a foothold, but now I'm okay. So, but it's, I mean, it has been a process, but this is part of why I do what I do, because I know it is a process. And also let me say this, one of the reasons why I speak and tell people my past, because this is not anything that I ever, if you look at me, that you would look at me and be like, oh, really? You know, most people are like, really? You know, what happened? You know, I'm educated, I come from an educated family. You know, I have like all the things that people would think, you know, would just, it just doesn't make any sense. So that means in my mind that and I know that there are other women like me that have those, you know, they're educated, they've, you know, been successful, whatever, but sometimes you just hit bad times. But they don't speak out because of the guilt and the shame. And we are the ones that can connect with people. We are the ones that can connect with these kids because we've been there and we know, but we're too ashamed to stand up for our own truth. And I think that's horrible. And I don't want to die knowing that I, you know, have this thing where I can help people, but I was too ashamed and too fearful what people would think. So I've kept it in the closet, and I can't help anyone. So because when I got home from Australia, I didn't have to tell anybody. You know, that left out in Australia, but I did because, you know, I thought I could help. And also I needed to help myself, too, and to cleanse of and to heal. So, but hopefully more people will come out, especially, I mean, we need, like, more black women in this fight and stuff. So, you know, it could be a powerful thing when you've healed from something and then you reach back and you're able to help, too. So, I don't know, keep our fingers crossed that more people are in the fight with sex trafficking. But there's a lot of, you know, powerful people that are working. And so we have to be thankful for those that are working in the fight. Like I mentioned, Nola Brantley, who's an amazing young woman, and from Missy and Sarai Theolinda Smith. I think her last name is Smith. She's Dreamcatchers. And there's also New Day for Children, Kathy Wilson, and they have, they're one of the places that actually has some beds for kids, and they're in the Bay Area as well. So there are a lot of people who are really, you know, putting their lives and like everything on the line to help these kids. It's just trying to get more people involved in the fight would be amazing. So that's why I do what I do, Wanda. Yep. And I'm fine, yeah. You know. I'm actually, like, this is the best, like, that I have been pretty much in all my life. I'll just put it that way. I don't have very much. And I've traveled all over the world, you know, have seen and been able to do some extraordinary things. And I'm probably at the most peace now in my life, ever in my life, right now. Because I feel like I'm doing my purpose. Like, I have so much joy. I wake up. People are like, what is wrong with you? Like, at work, they're like, what is wrong with you? Why are you always so happy? But I'm just thankful that I'm able. Yeah, they just look at me. I catch people, and they just are like, and they start laughing. And I'm like, aha, that's good. It's catching. Joy is contagious. So this is a... For me, you know, on the inside, this is the best that I've been in, like, pretty much all my life. I can say that.
Yeah. Yeah, I was reading some more of your bio, and that, you know, you performed your work, your social justice poetic pieces in Washington, D.C., through the Network for Victim Recovery,
mm-hmm.
The D.C. fundraiser, and in Philadelphia, Justice Conference. Poetry Slam,
mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, are you from this area? Are you from San Francisco, the area, or have you? Is this a place that you chose to be your home, but this is not where you, you know, you were raised?
Mm-mm. I was born and raised in Oakland. I'm actually my father was actually born and raised in Oakland, which is unusual because I'm 51, so. You know, that generation, usually they're from down, their parents are from down south, but my father was actually raised in West Oakland. Went to Cole School, went to McClyman's, was actually one of the first black probation officers, graduated from state, is an Alpha Phi Alpha man, president of the Alphas when he was at San Francisco State. You know, he's a real, like, he worked at the Defermery Park with Dorothy Pitts. So I kind of follow in his tradition of, you know, of helping people. So he So yeah, no, I'm second generation Oakland, born and raised. But I used to work in D.C. I worked in D.C. as a legislative assistant. So I still kind of have ties to Washington D.C. and my nephew and his wife are back there as well. And she actually asked me to come back as a part of that fundraiser. So I went back. And then was able to, I actually went to Bono's One Summit while I was back there as well during that trip. So I still have some connections to Washington.
Mm-hmm. So that's good. That's really good. So is your academic training in political science or in law or something like that?
It is international relations. And it's weird because I've had like this crazy circuitous like life. You know, I've... when I went back to, because first I actually worked as a reporter in the state capitol, which is weird because now I go and I lobby the state capitol. That's what I'm always like when people are like, I don't know what I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, believe.
Hello? We lost Regina. Oh, my goodness. I was expecting her to yes, a second. This is oh, nope. So we're going to play a song I thought it would be really apropos. Oh, no, I see her, but I don't hear her. We're going to play Megli Hadaro's Walls, because she's talking about that scripture from the Bible that she chose as the title for her her piece, 52 Letters. I thought that would be really apropos. Walls, in light of that. Well, let me let you know what else is going to be happening today on the show. We're going to be playing an interview with Nancy Kelly, who for 25 years has produced and directed independent documentary and narrative films. Her latest is Rebels with a Cause, which is opening night feature for the third annual San Francisco Screen Film Festival, which is... continuing, they had some pre-festival screenings, and tonight is, what is it, tonight? Tomorrow, May 30th through June 5th, these films are going to be screening at New People Cinema and the David Barr Center in Berkeley, New People in San Francisco, at 1746 Post, and the David Barr is the Austin Way. To get back into the studio. Don't worry. We are coming back. Regina? Uh-oh. Okay. So Regina has not in the studio anymore. We're going to play Walls really quickly and see if Regina can call us back. Tonight at the Oakland Main Library, Elaine Lee is going to be talking about traveling to Brazil. That should be really fun. And I just got an email that Ice Life has a new project that's being unveiled in East Oakland at one of the housing projects out on 77th Avenue. And so that should be really interesting as well. I have more details on that a little bit later on when I can get back into my email account. I'm having trouble right now. All the way around.
Be gentle, be gentle, gentle with me. I feel a fragile this year. Gentle with me, I feel a fragile this year. Be gentle, gentle with me, me and the walls. This walls, I counted 10,000 walls around my heart. Now can't see my eye walls. Some are made of cardboard and some are made of clay. Some are made of memories for that sad, sad day. Oh, I know every single one of my, my walls. Oh, I walk amongst them, in between them, shout from on top of them. I walk amongst them, in between them, shout from on top of my eye. Oh, I. Some hold bones like graveyard stones, like fossils in the sea. Well, some are painted red for mystic me. Thank you. flower growing on sideways outer cracks. And one day that plant may grow a hole in that wall, will crumble, 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 crumble. They appear and disappear. There's one that knows when you're not here. It's when I miss you that I see right through that wall. Oh, 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 oh. But when you're and mud, oh, why do you do this to me? Do you, do you, do you, do you, do you? Can a wall have roots or branches like a tree? Well, I don't know how deep this goes.
That was Regina Carter performing Interi from Reverse Thread, an earlier one of her wonderful collections of music. And before that, again, that was Nick Lee Padaro performing Walls from her On a Day Like Today, her debut album. And again, we were speaking about the third annual San Francisco Green Film Festival, which is May 30th through June 5th, and there's some great films, films looking at how the United States, particularly the United States government, dumps its, technology waste, such as computers and other types of waste like that, you know, that kind of solid waste, in places like Ghana, and where our waste, the United States waste, is polluting the environment there and causing really hazards to the people that live nearby, as well as people who have to drink the water, the wildlife, et cetera. And there's a great film screening called Care of Light, and that film is going to be screening Saturday, June 1st, as a part of a screening and a panel discussion. We'll look at how to actually reuse, because there really is no waste, we find out, with regards to our computers and our technology. And so plugged into the manufacture of these different types of devices, like TVs and things like that, needs to be plugged in, how to recycle them and reuse all of the various metals and other types of the glass and the frames and things like that. This is all actually reusable. And then there's another film that's also screening on Saturday. Saturday's a great day to hang out at New People Cinema. There's a film called Lost Source, and that film looks at a man who has immigrated to the United States, you know, post-earthquake, post-cholera epidemic, and he wants to bring water, clean water, to his village, Lost Source, and he's working at Princeton as a janitor. And together with the students there and an NGO, they're able to bring clean water, a viaduct, to his village. And this particular film is narrated by Don Cheadle, and it's called Lost Source, and it's directed by Patrick Shin. And again, we're going to play an interview with director Nancy Kelly, which is the opening night film. But the film, we've actually had Kalyani Mom on the air, and her film, A River Changes Course, is going to be screening as well on Saturday at 7. And I believe she's probably going to be in the house because she lives, I believe, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Actually, she does live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm not sure what side of the bay she lives on, but if she's in town, I'm sure you can catch her there, as well as some of the crew, because everyone's local. And so Nancy Kelly, she's actually a San Francisco-based director, she and her husband, who is the filmmaker, who is actually on camera. And together they make these marvelous films. And this particular film, which got all kind of awards and all kind of ovations, since the screening at the Mill Valley Film Festival, which was sold out, was so sold out that she didn't even have a ticket for her own film screening. So Rebels with a Cause celebrates the people and passion that save the coastal wonders that will become the Point Reyes National Seashore and the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. With California's rapid population rise in the 1950s, the California coast seemed destined to follow the prevalent pattern of suburban development. But these rebels changed the fate of the land. Their efforts set new precedents for protecting open space and shaped the environmental movement as we know it today. an audience award winner, as I mentioned already, at the 2012 Mill Valley Film Festival. The film features interviews with several prominent Bay Area residents, including Huey Johnson, co-founder of the Trust for Public Land, and the founder of the Resource Renewal Institute, Amy Meyer and Edgar Wayburn, co-chairs, people for Golden Gate National Recreation Area, Martin Griffin, founder of the Audubon Canyon Ranch, Phyllis Faber and Ellen Strauss, co-founders of Marin Agricultural Land Trust, Martin Rosen, former president of the Trust for Public Land. So I'm going to play that interview with Nancy right now, and we'll see what happens after that.
I just wanted to tell you that I just loved your film about these activists that were committed to saving public space.
Thank you.
It's just such a great story. How did you come to know the story? Do you live in in Point Reyes or something?
No, but I do live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and when I first moved from San Francisco out to Marin, just because I couldn't stand, I lived always in neighborhoods that were affordable, but you didn't have any, they weren't residential, so there was never any control over the noise, in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved out to Marin, and I was so surprised that there was so much parkland and open space so close to the city. And so I read this book by John Hart called San Francisco's Wilderness Next Door.
Mm-hmm.
That talked a lot about different areas in northern, the northern coast that were supposed to be developed and how that was defeated. And many years later, when Nancy Dobbs, the president and CEO of KRCB up in Sonoma, when she asked me if I would be interested in making a documentary about saving the coast,
mm-hmm.
I was just like, yeah. Instantly, yeah. And really, I should have gone home and talked to Kenji and asked him whether he was interested, because with that one word, I committed us to 8 years of work. but I just, those lands, they were my salvation,
mm-hmm.
So I could live in this, heavily populated area.
Yeah. I mean, there are just so many great stories, from the wonderful congressman, Clem Miller, to the, he was a council person or a supervisor or something.
Oh, yeah, Gary Giacomini.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great storyteller, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then those attorneys. Oh my goodness.
I know. And those three attorneys are still around. They're very hale and hearty, and they
mm-hmm.
are so much fun
mm-hmm.
to be with. And they've been coming to a lot of screenings.
Oh really?
Oh yeah.
Nice.
Yep.
Wow. I bet that Mill Valley Film Festival screening was like standing room only.
Oh my God! The first day the tickets went on sale for the
mm-hmm.
Mill Valley Film Festival, the first morning, the Rebels sold out.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even have a ticket for Nancy Dobbs at that point.
Ah, wow!
And so I just the festival just said, just go up to the box office every day and see if anybody has turned in any blocks of tickets. And then, get your hands on them and get people to pay you for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, here we are trying to finish our film. We finished it 3 days before the premiere, and every day I'm running up to the box office in Mill Valley making best friends with the head of the box office, Ben. And, one day, it was always we don't have any. Nope, it's zero. It's sold out. And then one day, 23 tickets appeared magically, and I was like, those are mine.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
And really, when at both screenings after the film, Kenji and I would go up and say, do you want to meet some rebels? And the crowd just roared. And when we got them all up on the stage, both times the audience stood up and applauded for them.
Mm-hmm.
People told me they cried. It was really great for everyone concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I think that those people got some recognition that was long deserved.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And I just love the way in your film, when the different developers would come in, you would show us what it would look like if they had succeeded. And I'm thinking, how is she doing this? Like, you know, sort of this film creative visualization. and then they don't win. But you let us see exactly what it would have looked like.
Oh, no. I mean, like that Marincello city?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that image of what the city would have looked like
had the
developer's dream come true with an actual model that he had in his office on Bridgeway in Sausalito that he used to, you know, sell people on the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard that model was around somewhere, and thought I looked for years to find that thing, but finally did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the guys, a bunch of model makers who used to work for Lucas, who were at a place called Kerner Optical, they took it on as a special project to clean and get that thing camera ready.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a beautiful job. They were so enthusiastic about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it really brought the developer's dream to life in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, but then when you had footage of it being occupied, you had people going, you know, like they lived there. You know, that footage that you brought in that showed people shopping and,
And holding up the window frame to choose what was the best view from that hill.
Mm-hmm.
Those things, we knew that we need to set the cultural context, you know, because now it doesn't seem that surprising that there were conservationists or environmentalists and that they wanted to keep open space. But, you know, in the early 1960s and the late 1950s, you know, those people were few and far between and they didn't have any examples. And really the prevailing belief was that development was good.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we found what's that guy's name? He's Prelinger, you know, Rick Prelinger.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Bay Area guy, and he has big archives and really has an appreciation for sort of corporate situations where they hired well-known artists who were just probably trying to make ends meet, but who brought like a special thing to shooting some things that were rather ordinary or sort of oriented towards advertising or marketing. And that was like that, those shots were often from Prelinger, and, you know, he could name, you know, the well-known filmmakers from those eras that film those things. But it did help us to bring, you know, those like kind of long ago times to life.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And it was, you know, your story is of is almost like a mystery. You know, the Point Reyes National Seashore, and how you know, Congressman Clem Miller, you know, how he really he was real tenacious in his vision, and he wasn't even a native Californian, but he realized how important it was to preserve this wonderful seashore, and it was just really great, you know, the way it took several, you know, presidencies.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the first films or first mentions of Richard Nixon where he's actually shown in a positive light.
We never were able to find the right place in the film for what Stuart Udall said,
mm-hmm.
Which was a lot of times presidents are finishing off business that was started, you know, an administration or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he described how starting with Kennedy, there were, and going through Johnson and Nixon up until the wall that the environmental movement hit when Reagan was elected, that there was a lot of that kind of continuum of preserving open space and wilderness and creating parks for the, you know, burgeoning population. I mean, the United States had a population explosion in those days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So talk about, you know, some of these rebels, you know, maybe we could start with the more recent addition to the wonderful landscape, which is, you know, the expansion of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, which that story is just really wonderful. And then backtrack perhaps to, you know, the whole idea of preserving, you know, this the seashore. And I just love the story of the integration of the ranching and the farming with the natural, you know, the landscape along the seashore, and how even today there's a little resistance, but from the person you were interviewing,
yeah, from Joe Mendoza.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the most contemporary of the rebels, I mean, a lot of them who are still alive are still active,
mm-hmm.
very active in the environmental movement. The most contemporary of them was Ellen Strauss and Phyllis Faber,
mm-hmm.
Who got the idea to create the Marin Agricultural Land Trust, which made it possible for a lot of the farms
mm-hmm.
outside of the parks to stay in private hands, but turn their development rights over to the Agricultural Land Trust for a substantial fee. And what that means is that if a particular family wants to sell their land, that they can only sell it for agricultural use.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Ellen and Phyllis's idea that they came up with while walking out in the fields of the Strauss family dairy. And it was the first agricultural land trust in the country. And they thought of it. Let's see, and then going back, there was Gary Giacomini,
mm-hmm.
Who ran on a platform of allowing a very large amount of acres, 60 acres, to be the minimum lot size, which, you know, drove the developers crazy because, you know, they want on every acre to have like five houses.
Mm-hmm.
It's not profitable. It wasn't profitable for them in those days. And, you know, Gary waged that fight, went all the way to the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
and they won.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Right. And that part was really cool, the way he was sitting there with this developer saying, oh, bring me the person who can say yes. He said, I am the person who can say yes, but I'm saying no.
Oh, I'm the guy. Yeah. And, you know, Gary is a great storyteller, and he told us a couple of stories that, of course, there were no cameras witnessing,
mm-hmm.
you know, these things, like when he went to his family and they tried to pressure him into voting no against the, you know, the 60-acre minimum zoning,
mm-hmm.
And then the story about the developer pressuring him.
Mm-hmm.
So we really had to ask ourselves in the editing room, what are we going to use? And Hindi Yamamoto, who's the editor, and my husband,
mm-hmm.
he's been a fan of the Pulitzer Prize-winning animator Mark Fiore for the longest time. Because I don't know, do you know Mark's work?
I'm not sure.
He's on SF Gate and a lot of other places, but he does very critical and amusing political animation.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And you know, he's very much a leftist, so Kenji is a big fan of his, and so even though we don't know him, we sent him an email asking him if he would talk to us and telling him a little about the story, and he was raised in Marin. He was just like right there. He really wanted to do it, and he was great, but he was able to bring things alive that we had absolutely no images for.
Yeah, that is really nice. And then I love, like, you know, you had a spy in there, you know, and he would go get on the phone. That was like,
oh,
really.
Oh, God. You know, we screened Rebels of the Cause in Bolinas on Saturday night, this past Saturday night.
Yes.
And in the community center, which holds, I guess, 170 people, and it was standing room only. And when that, those two photographs of Greg Hewlett, that was the spy's name.
Yeah.
When those came up, he doesn't live in Bolinas. He's down in Mexico in Chiapas, I guess, in Chiapas, fighting with the rebels or something. But he's a much beloved character. This roar came up from the crowd that was just, I mean, that'll never happen anywhere else. But and then after the screening, I met a woman who was Greg's girlfriend at the time, and she told me that she was with him at 2 o'clock in the morning when he called Marty Griffin to say, you better get moving.
Nice. Oh, that's awesome. Wow, that's hecka cool. Wow.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, yeah. Is that the same vicinity where Kent Island is?
Yes. Yes, Kent Island then looked very different than it does now, because Kent Island now has trees on it.
Mm.
At that time, it was just kind of a sand spit.
Hello?
Hi.
Okay. I thought we had faded.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know what I was going to say? My favorite thing about the developer's plan for Bolinas Lagoon was the heliport.
Yeah, that was really great. That was a wonderful victory as well.
Yep.
And that was amazing that people, you know, the various organizations and representatives were able to, like, buy such huge pieces of land for, like, $100 or this or that.
Well, that was usually the deposit.
Oh, okay.
And then they would have to go out and raise millions. Like, I don't remember what Huey Johnson and the Nature Conservancy paid for Orangello. I want to say $15 million, but I could be wrong. But and then Kent Island, I think that the Audubon Society, the Marin Audubon Society, I think that they, or Audubon Canyon Ranch, you know, and Marty Griffin, he gave Mrs. Kent like $2,000 of his own money, but then I think he had to raise like 80 or something. Thousand. And he, you know, he put together a little money from the Nature Conservancy. I think it was a loan, and then got a little money from somewhere else, and from, I think, from the Marine Conservation League. And then he, I don't know, then he got, I think, a loan of $50,000 from Audubon Canyon Ranch or something. And he was just, you know, running around. He's a doctor, and he would, like, ask his patients if they wanted to put money in.
That's great. Yeah, because he's 100, right?
No, that was Edgar Wayburn. Marty, I think, is in his early 90s. I just saw him. He came to the Bolinas screening.
Yeah.
And he is much beloved there. Much beloved.
Yeah.
You know, but people just, you know, when he came up to do the Q&A with us, people gave him a standing ovation.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, it's just so wonderful that you're sharing these stories with us about these wonderful men and women. It's like, and families, because it was like, for some of them, it was like a whole family affair. Like the princess, the woman who, I guess she was people for Golden Gate National Recreation Area.
And, Amy Meyer.
Yeah, she was funny.
Yeah.
And she talked about how, you know, she have to clear the dining room table.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, I think that her persistence and her just unbelievable strength in the face of adversity and her persuasiveness I think she even surprised herself, you know, from those early days. But she is still a force to be contended with in protecting the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. And she wrote a book about it, about her experience.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what's it called?
It's called, Saving the Golden Gate,
mm-hmm.
How America Got a Great National Park or something like that.
Yeah, because was that a part of the whole move to when conservationists were looking at all of the various former forts and looking at how that particular land could be sort of made into a part of a public, landscape
mm-hmm.
and park? Is that
right.
And then someone went to a congressman or something, and he said, "Don't tell me what you think you can get. Tell me what you want."
Right.
Yeah. Tell us that story.
Well, the congressman was Phil Burton.
Okay.
And if you go to Fort Mason,
mm-hmm.
there's a statue of Phil Burton just sort of on the. From Fort Mason, there's kind of a rolling green hill that goes down to the marina and the road there.
Yes,
And so there's a statue of him sort of looking over that land and over the Golden Gate.
Yeah, I know that statue. Wow.
Yeah, you know that statue, right?
Yeah, sure do.
And he was one of the most effective congressmen for preserving parks. He was amazing, and the reason he was because he made sure that everybody on both sides of the aisle got, when they were talking about like a park for us in Northern California, they were also talking about a national park for people just south of Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
you know, very close to Cleveland, and, you know, and to another one in New York called the Gateway National
mm-hmm.
Recreation Area. I mean, he was so effective in getting people what they want
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and encouraging Edgar Wayburn to go for what he wanted and not to just come in already compromising, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when Kendrick and I were at the Cleveland International Film Festival, we did a panel after one of the screenings of Rebels with the superintendent of the Cuyahoga Valley National Park, and which is, I swear to God, it's like 30 minutes from downtown Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about how Bill Burton was responsible for them getting that park
mm-hmm.
at the same time as we got the Golden Gate National Recreation Area.
Nice.
I mean, he was great for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But what I thought was just so funny was the way that Amy Meyer said, you know, he wasn't an outdoor guy at all. He was a man who thought that, you know, the only reason to go outside was to smoke a cigarette.
Yeah, that was really funny.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow. I really liked how you were able to connect the stories, you know, between what was happening in the San Francisco Bay Area.
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
I said I really liked the way you were able to connect the stories between what was happening, you know, to the San Francisco Bay Area with regards to, you know, protecting the shoreline and open space development to how this developer, the one that wanted to do the that development in Marin County, his eyes, or maybe not that developer, but on other public space and parks in other places in the country. And so if it worked here, then it would be easy for him to be able to build on these other places. And so,
mm-hmm.
I like the way you were connecting the dots there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Wanda, they're starting to look at me because I have to get in the car and go
elsewhere.
Did you do have one last question?
Yeah, one last question. And I was wondering, with regards to yourself as a director, you've made some really wonderful films, how this particular story changed you.
Oh, I think I just came to have a much greater appreciation for the power of individual people to accomplish things, you know, mm-hmm. to change their world.
Mm-hmm.
And the effect of that story on other people, you know, who are doing things like trying to stop a McDonald's from coming to their, you know, their town or something like that. But mm-hmm. I think it just gave me a much greater appreciation for a place that I've always loved since I moved to the Bay Area in 1980.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the great story and continued success.
Thank you.
Yeah, you take good care.
Thanks for taking a look at the film.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you so much.
Okay.
You take care.
Talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So we were speaking to director Nancy Kelly about her film, she and her husband's film, Rebels with a Cause, which is the opening night premiere at the San Francisco Green Film Festival. And it's actually going to be having a theatrical release as well in June. I believe it opens June 7th in Marin County at the Raphael Theater, which is kind of appropriate. And then it's going to be moving along to other other theaters in Berkeley and in San Francisco. And I was looking to give you those details in a few minutes. my computer is moving kind of slow this morning, but we shall see if I can get this information for you in a minute, hopefully. Let's take too long. Oh my goodness. Okay. So we're going to just go ahead and just play a song. I thought it'd be kind of appropriate to play Optimism, VJ Iyer's piece. I was thinking about between two pieces. VJ Iyer playing The Village of the Virgins, Ellington composition, or Optimism. I am torn. Which one should I play? I think I will play Optimism, because the Rebels with a Cause were certainly optimistic, and they won the fight. Thank you. Well, that was B.J. Iyer, Optimism, and wanted to let you know that the opening of the Rebels with the Cause, the movie's not going to be opening in Berkeley. I misspoke. It's opening actually May 31st at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco, and then it moves to the San Rafael Film Center, the Christopher B. Smith San Rafael Film Center on June 7th, and then it closes out a really pretty nice run June 14th through 16th at Cinema One in San Jose. So there's some opportunities to catch it, and I'm sure that the director and the producer, cinematographer, are going to be present as well, and possibly some of those revolution, those rebels with the cause. So that should be really awesome. And I'm thinking about closing out the show with pre-recorded interview with wonderful artist who we had the opportunity to speak to last week about the opening of the completion of this wonderful sculpture that's in Henry J. Kaiser Memorial Park, 19th and Rashida Muhammad Street. And it's the sculpture is called Remember Them, Champions for Humanity. And it's 52 feet long by 25 feet high sculpture. And it's, you know, larger than life depiction of these wonderful, wonderful human and civil rights activists. So I'm going to close out with that particular interview. And I hope everyone has a wonderful day. And this is just, this is the second of the final interviews for this summer that are going to be coming to you live. I'm getting ready to go on vacation. So you're going to be, we're going to be doing like a best of series for Wanda's Picks. As soon as I figure out how I'm going to be broadcasting remotely from abroad, I'm going to be traveling, and I'll be back in August and let you know all about it. Or you can check out the, my website and wandaspicks.com to find out sort of where I am in the world, and you can check my blog as well. And so we're going to try to stay connected, but the times might not be what they are here in Pacific Standard Time, because I'm going to be in a whole other time zone, about 10 hours ahead of this particular one. So I'll be a little day ahead of you. All right, so here is Mario Kyoto, the artist of the wonderful piece, Remember Them, Champions for Humanity. And the exhibit opens. It's going to be a grand opening, christening, with all these great folks that are going to be speaking this Friday, May 31st at 3 o'clock.
Yeah. So how do you pronounce your last name, Mario?
It's actually pronounced Kyoto.
Kyoto. Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, it sounds Japanese, but it's actually Italian.
Yeah, I noticed that you're an Italian ancestry, and
right.
You sound like you're like a child artistic prodigy.
I'm not sure what I am sometimes, but the art is it's kind of threaded into me, because, and I say that because as far back as I can remember,
mm-hmm.
was that impulse to want to articulate through creating. And I mean, I'm talking way back. Even on the walls of my crib, they kept photos of stuff that I was scribbling on. And
wow.
I don't know. It's just one of those weird things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then your style is, you know, so classic. I mean, and you know, sort of like the kind of art that, you know, the Renaissance period. It's just really, really big and has that old feel to it. like classics, even like the Greeks and stuff?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because there's no question that as I got older, especially during my adolescence,
mm-hmm.
I was really exposed to Michelangelo and Rodin.
Yeah.
And that really just got me so excited,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to emulate them, and that's how I practiced. You know, I would copy things that they did, and anywhere I could copy, I would practice,
mm-hmm.
and it always stuck with me, and I don't have, you know, this thing that everything has to be one kind of art or one kind of style. I see all around the country different cultural affairs departments and art commissions, and they're always trying to advocate a certain style, which I kind of think is wrong. It should be every type of style, from super real to abstract, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, art's supposed to reflect how we feel about things, and everybody feels different.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So talk about, you know, this big, you know, this huge major project in Oakland that's going to have its unveiling on May 31st at 3
right.
o'clock. It's going to be so
yeah.
exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting. You know, it's been going on for about 12 years, a little over 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
The first time that the inspiration and the feeling hit me was literally minutes after I saw the airplanes crashing into the Twin Towers,
mm-hmm.
On 9/11, 12 and a half years ago.
Yeah. It's amazing that it's been 12 and a half years, huh? It seems like yesterday.
In some ways, it seems like it's been in an instant, and in some ways, it seems like an eternity.
Mm-hmm.
But it was that moment that everything kind of became very clear to me. I, for two decades leading up to that time, have been very successful in creative businesses, including I was the president of a public company that specialized in a lot of movie and Halloween and seasonal products that were worldwide. And, you know, art was obviously my life,
mm-hmm.
but it, there was always something missing. And I always had this idea, long before 9/11, about how, you know, what could I create or do that could have an impact on people to get along better? I mean, that was it in its simplest form.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt a little guilty almost as an artist, because artists tend to struggle a lot, and yet I was doing so well and it came so easy, even though I worked extremely hard, and there was this big empty spot, and then 9/11 hit, and also I would add, I would always have been a fan of history and the change makers, and you know, I always followed the lives of Lincoln, Churchill, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King,
mm-hmm.
Frederick Douglass. These were all these people who inspired me.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I never knew what to do with all that. And then it hit me after I saw the Twin Towers. We really need to start creating things that encourage people to see how much they are alike and not unalike, and to find those common denominators. Because, you know, 9/11, the first thing that happened was, oh, well, those people from those Muslim countries are all bad people.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the news and the media spread like wildfire. And yet we all know that it was an extremist action of very few people. And I thought, if I could create something that shows the similarities in people, maybe it's a starting point. I don't pretend to have all the answers or this is the definitive way. But if we have reminders, all of these people from different cultures, that they all went through hardship, they all gave themselves up for other people's benefit, and that it was not expected from these people, that just ordinary people like you and I can make a difference, and we can affect people for the betterment, and that we are not so much the black, the white, the Asian, the this, the that, but we are the human race. And you hear that periodically from people, but it's like people forget about that, that, you know, we all come from the same planet, and no one can deny that, regardless of what you believe in.
That's so true.
So that's how it started, even though, I mean, that's how the Remember Them monument was born, if you will. That's its conception, although the idea for years, I mean, I'm going back to teens thinking about what can I do. And everything I did, you know, came to be used as some part of this in some way. And at that time, I made the conscious decision to literally stop doing my regular commercial work. I thought it was only going to be a 2 or 3 year journey. It's 12 and a half years now.
Yeah.
It totally changed my lifestyle. When I first introduced the idea, there were not very many people who really got it. And if anything, people said, you know, nice airy-fairy idea, it'll never happen. The only person who supported me initially was the Oakland Chamber of Commerce, the president, which is so ironic because the president, Joe Herberta, the president of the Chamber of Commerce, you know, I think this was a big leap for him. Very conservative and government-oriented person. And, you know, I was talking about bringing everyone into the fold and put them all on an even keel. And he absolutely embraced it, supported it. Probably we could not have done it without him and him helping and championing the cause. But it was funny because right after 9/11 and right when I started doing the initial sketches and talking about it, I sent out over 500 proposals nationwide. And a handful came back, and it was always the typical thing. Nice idea, but we don't see how this physically could ever happen. So I bit my bullet, and I made a huge decision to, as I said, stop my regular commercial business. I took all my resources of the time.
Wow.
And funded as far as I could go. In the third year, Kaiser Permanente saw it more developed. So you had a clear picture of what this was going to be, and they really embraced it. And that's when we knew, no matter how long it was going to take to do, it was going to happen.
Oh, okay.
And there were so many times during these 12 years that we were going strong, and then funding would end, and then it was like, what are we going to do now? And somehow, some way, in between, you know, the starving to make it happen, we managed to continue to go. People would step up when we least expected it. I mean, it's been, I could have never scripted this journey. It was certainly more difficult than I originally thought it was going to be.
So, in the third year, was that when you had the Maya Angelou came and Ruby Bridges, grown woman?
Actually,
was that
Maya Angelou came very early on?
Okay.
Yeah, she came very early on, and she was one of the people who really inspired me and pushed me to keep going. That was about 2002. Maybe just before 2003.
Okay.
And she came to the studio. It was a private thing. She just showed up, and her voice, very stern, said, "I understand you're trying to make a monument about humanity." And she came in, and she didn't say a word. She just stared at the model for about a minute. And then she broke down crying, and she said it was about time. And she said, "No words are necessary. I get it." And that, we had extensive conversations after that. I've gotten to know her son really well.
Yeah, Guy.
To be involved and participate in activities with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, in about early 2007, late 2006,
mm-hmm.
You may be referring to that event.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And which is funny because the time has just flown by.
Yeah,
but it was a while ago.
Yeah, and you released Doves.
Yes. Now that was the 2011 event.
Oh, that was 11. Oh, so 7,
yeah.
11. Okay.
Yeah, that was the 2011 event.
Okay.
There have been so many events, so much fundraising, so many awareness
mm-hmm.
Meetings to do this, so many public hearings
mm-hmm.
to get it passed, and along the way, I met some incredible people that I would have never otherwise have met, and can honestly say they're friends who I speak with on either a daily or weekly basis, like Ruby Bridges,
mm-hmm.
like Ambassador Shabazz, who is Malcolm X's oldest daughter.
Nice.
Juliana Roosevelt, who now mm-hmm. we collaborate and work on projects together.
Mm, really?
She's a landscape architect.
Oh.
And her cause is very similar to our cause, where we are trying to change environments that are not expected, that could make a difference in urban areas or questionable areas. And she and I are working on a project in Richmond, California, together that is the beginning of something that we think is very, very special.
Oh, nice.
And we'll make everyone more aware of it as the designs, I've been working on the designs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really this, it's part of this much bigger plan that evolved from Remember Them, that we kind of have coined the Freedom March of Art to try to bring it to the areas where it actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And in areas, again, where you're not expecting it to happen.
Hmm.
Because this entire Bay Area is a tremendous hotbed of history that most people don't know about. And, you know, between Oakland and Richmond alone, so much happened before the Civil Rights Movement
mm-hmm.
that is not really in very many books. I mean, most people don't know that this was one of the very first places that you had a business, namely under Henry J. Kaiser, that stopped segregating employees and did equal pay for equal work for both, regardless of your race or religion, and whether you were a man or a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he fired entire executive staffs who tried to oppose him on that. And there are a lot of other things that happened here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have the whole Native American Ohlone Indians who were born here that most people don't know anything about that history, and it needs to be told.
Mm-hmm. Yes, certainly.
Then you have the immigrants coming from Italy, from
mm-hmm.
Germany, from China, from the turn of the century. You know, up until the 60s, that was such an important part of what happened here. You had Henry J. Kaiser in the 30s who put out the call to African Americans in the South to come work over here to create the planes and the ships that, you know, would protect this country.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first one to do a health program for people, for employees. Most people don't realize that that was the first of its kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, I mean, the story.
And then we look at Kaiser Permanente now, right?
Yeah, and you know, the irony of that, Kaiser Permanente was the smallest thing he did.
Mm.
And yet, that's what we all see. Nobody really understands what he did. And, you know, he had a basically a sixth grade education.
Hmm.
And, you know, I mean, and that's just one microcosm of this area. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, but then, you know, back to Kaiser, I mean, there was that great exhibit at the Oakland Museum, and then you saw, you know, that he was also international. I think he built a dam in Ghana.
Oh, yeah. Franklin Roosevelt said he was the guy who should have been president of the United States. But he believed Henry J.'s. And he told him, you should run. And he said, I'll run as fast as I can away from politics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably smarter for that. But it's not just Henry Kaiser. I mean, there's so many other stories in
mm-hmm.
this area that
yeah.
need to be remembered. And the funny thing is, there are stories everywhere. And we need to recognize that telling those stories is a very powerful thing that helps people and helps the environment and encourages, you know, creating and being reverent about things as opposed to destroying or destructive nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you mentioned, you know, other heroes from this area, like Dr. Marcus Foster and Carmen Flores. I don't know Carmen Flores.
Carmen Flores was basically a, you know, a bright spotlight in the local area for people of Hispanic background who really had nowhere to go. She helped with education. She helped local government to try to help create programs. I mean, we, among the circles who know her, she's kind of considered the female Cesar Chavez because she stayed in this area. She didn't go beyond this area. Whereas Cesar Chavez, as you know, you know, is national and internationally known. But Carmen did it here.
Hmm.
And her roots are still here. Her family's still here.
So is she a contemporary of, or was she a contemporary of Dolores Huerta?
They were partners, basically.
Okay, so they were all together. Okay.
Yeah, they were all together at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and that's the reason why you see both of them
mm-hmm.
on the monument.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have Alida Abrams, who's also on the monument.
Mm-hmm.
This is a local champion
mm-hmm.
who did so much for helping victims of rape.
Oh, nice.
That before was non-existent,
mm-hmm.
and it was secretly done with Oakland Police Department officers who did this totally on their own time.
Mm.
And, you know, I mean, and also on this current section,
mm-hmm.
you have Royal Towns,
mm.
who was the first African-American fire captain and formed organizations to allow young African-Americans to integrate into the fire department in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And most people don't know, he didn't get paid. He had to do it as a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only way he could do it.
Uh-huh.
And he's on that.
Mm-hmm.
Ina Coldreth is on.
Oh, great. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, it sounds like you know who she is.
Yeah. She was a librarian, and she was the first, Poet Laureate, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, she was the first Poet Laureate, and she started she was the first librarian,
mm-hmm.
but what most people don't know is how she got here.
How'd she get here?
She got here, she escaped from Utah. She was the daughter of Joseph Smith, and because she did not want to be married at 12 years old.
Mm-hmm. 12?
Yes.
Hmm.
And she made her way over here. She was really into literature. And she had kind of like a boarding house. And she had all the local authors stay there, including Jack London.
Nice.
And, you know, I mean, these are pretty unbelievable people during their time
mm-hmm.
of what they've done. And we also have Ansel Hall.
Hmm.
And most people don't know who Ansel Hall is. Ansel Hall was the person who started the National Park Services.
Oh.
Became the National Park Services. He started with the East Bay Regional
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, for protecting the environment,
mm-hmm.
Really making the hills look like the way they do.
Yeah.
We're hoping one of his family members will be there. And then the other local champion
mm-hmm.
that I put on there that I felt was really important was an Ohlone woman.
Mm-hmm.
There are very few to little stories of the specifics about the Ohlone, specifically people, a person. And I wanted to recognize the fact that they are the original people here. They're the people who started life, human life here.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to be remembered. And I consider the women or the woman, you know, that's the life giver.
Mm-hmm.
It's rarely a life taker. And that, to me, that's one of the highest symbols that you could have.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need a name for that, or that person.
Right. Yeah.
So,
do you have any other images or people that are representative of a larger idea? You know, like the Ohlone woman.
On section four of the project.
On the project in general.
Well, there's a total of 40 people
mm-hmm.
represented on the monument. There's 26 on the front side,
mm-hmm.
and then the 14 on the sides and spiraling around.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the makeup, it almost pretty much encompasses the whole world. Someone from each continent, or a few people from each continent.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, in the process, I was trying to create something that could, you know, speak to different people. That was intentional.
Mm-hmm.
But what wasn't intentional that I found kind of extraordinary is that when I came up with the final group, it really covered all the continents.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to like all these people, but there'll be someone there that you can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also important to note that I don't consider this like the definitive, you know, 40 people of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
I consider these just tremendous examples of people who made sacrifices for other people, and they come from all over the world, and it's a starting point. It's not an ending point. And it's a reminder for us, it's really about awareness, because if you can get people to be aware, you trigger a lot of other things. You trigger, you know, education, you trigger hope, which you hopefully leads into people taking action for the betterment of others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just noticing how you have, you know, you have Nelson Mandela, you also have, you know, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., and a lot of times, you know, Abraham Lincoln, you don't have some folks that you have depicted in the same conversation. So,
well, I'm glad you're saying that. That's very true. When I did my research and I was studying other monuments and
mm-hmm.
seeing what's out there, what attracts people, what makes people just walk by and not notice and whatever, just studying monument after monument,
mm-hmm.
it was shocking to me that no matter where I looked, it was always, well, this is the war monument, this is the white monument, this is the black monument, this
mm-hmm.
is the Asian monument, the Jewish monument. Nowhere is there a monument to humanity. There are some that insinuate, but they don't freely say it. And having Winston Churchill next to Malcolm X
mm-hmm.
is clearly a first. And I come back to, why would someone do that? Because they gave of themselves to help other people. That is the simplest and most important factor of what the common thread is among all of them,
mm-hmm.
that they were selfless for other people's benefit.
Right, yeah.
So I am proud of the fact
mm-hmm.
that. that we have, you know, it's clearly not everyone in the world there, but there's representation from all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And you have people, you know, a lot of times when you see monuments, the person died. And you got people that are alive and, you know, that are still with us in this, you know, in this monument. You know, besides Maya Angelou, who we've been speaking about quite a bit, you know, Ruby Bridges, as you already mentioned, Cesar Chavez just passed. You know, we've got...
Well, it was important to me that we have real-life living people so that young people in particular can see that these people are real and not just myths and the distortions of writings through histories that keep twisting and turning what people in history have done,
mm-hmm.
so that people can see for themselves, look, this person exists. They continue to do great things, and they also are just like you and me, imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is an important part. And the sad thing I have to say is when I started this project, Coretta King was alive, Rosa Parks was alive,
mm-hmm.
and that was hard when they passed away because I had just made contact with both of them.
Oh, wow!
And I've always hoped that, you know, that they would have been at this dedication. I've been lucky enough that not all of them, but most of them, there's been some representation who has visited
mm-hmm.
the Remember Them site or my studio during these years.
That's great. Yeah, because I know that, you know, you have, and I'm not certain how to pronounce it correctly, but Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yes, Thich Nhat Hanh.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and Rigoberta Menchu Tum.
Yes.
And Eli Wiesel?
Yeah, Wiesel.
Wiesel, yeah.
The funny thing about Thich Nhat Hanh
mm-hmm.
is, first of all, most people don't realize how old he really is, and he's alive.
He doesn't look that old, does he? I mean,
no,
you would never think 1926, like, for real?
No, and the irony of that one was when we had the unveiling back in 2011.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I really wanted him to be there because we were corresponding and there were some problems with his travel and whatnot. And that was on a Friday that we unveiled.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I can't quite remember. Whatever it was. The next Monday, I got a call from Governor Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I need you to come to my office in Oakland. I have a surprise for you.
Mm.
And I, of course, went over there, and I walk into the office, and there's Thich Nhat Hanh waiting.
Wow.
And we walked over to the monument, and what an experience it was with him, and to hear him talk. And, I mean, I'm telling you, there's no way this man's 87 years old, and he looks like he's about 38 or 40.
Mm.
And just everything he said was just with such a positive energy that just was what he said and what was around him. And, you know, he talked about so many different things, and then we got to have an afternoon tea with him. It was a real highlight for me in this entire project to actually be with him. It was for a full day then. And to hear him talk, he was so humble about everything, and he's so funny. And that's the other thing, you think it's going to be serious, and yet he's almost childlike, and always cracking a joke, and always taking everything in, and observing everything. It was quite an experience.
Mm-hmm. So did you have a team helping you, or did you sculpt every piece yourself?
Well, this is the process. There's a smaller scale model that is made first, and that I do from start to finish. All the drawings, the mm-hmm. design. Every time I make a full-scale sculpture, you have to do a smaller version to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, I mean, there's hundreds of studies I did and testing, trying to figure out how the positions of the faces, who's going to be there. Then came the scaling up, And I have a team of artisans who work with me, who have been with me quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And they help me do the mathematical scale up to a certain point. And then the last finish on everything, the skin of everything, everything that you see with your eyes down about 2 inches deep,
mm-hmm.
I sculpt all of that
mm-hmm.
on top of the structure that's built.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, I get my hands on every inch of it. And, you know, I make sure that, it, you know, every line, crease, eyeball,
mm-hmm.
ear, hairline, everything is as I do it. There's rock work on this one that I did have my assistants help with that
mm-hmm.
they worked on. But the actual people, the faces, the bodies, the hands, all of that, I do. I do all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are they a part of your Kyoto Art organization, you know, your business?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, they've all been with me a long time. And then we expand and contract according to projects that
mm-hmm.
we're working on.
Hmm.
You know, for most of the period of Remember Them working on it, I could not take other projects because it was, you know, it was like an octopus. There were so many parts to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the difficulty of the whole thing. It just, you know, I was locked in it. And most people need, you know, you need to take on other business to, you know, to pay bills and do whatnot financially. As I came to the end of 2011, we opened up the doors again to taking on projects that would be related to social justice projects.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea what was going to happen. And to my pleasant surprise, I was hit with kind of a wave of projects that are related.
So is that the Contrabands and Freedom Movement Monument in Alexandria, Virginia? Was that one of them?
Yeah, that's one of them. That's that, and we are finishing that right
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, is a tribute to, I don't know if you know the story or not, but that's where they uncovered 1,200 graves that, or a little over 1,200 graves that, that these were the people who migrated from Savannah to Alexandria, Virginia, who most of them thought they were coming into freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they said it was a free state at the time, it really wasn't.
Oh, so they were going back into slavery?
They were treated worse than slaves. They were put into barracks with any excuse. It's a terrible, terrible story, but the good part of the story are those people who endured and helped and made sure that, you know, a good number of them would survive. But this particular project is at the gravesite that even the city had, no pun intended, buried. And the Department of Transportation had built roads over.
Oh.
And then about 7 years ago, by accident, they started uncovering graves for some repair.
Mm-hmm.
And then, long story short, they wanted to put a memorial there. And there was all kinds of controversy. Even my being awarded the project, I had submitted my models and didn't think anything of it. I figured, you know, if we get this, I will be so happy. But, you know, there's other people that are probably there and closer.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, I found out I was awarded the project through the newspapers.
Mm.
The actual city hadn't even contacted me.
Wow.
Because there was so much controversy, there was so much misinformation. One person who thought he had won really didn't, but he was telling everybody that he won. And I had gotten wind of that through the newspaper, and I kind of just said, okay, well, they chose someone else. I understand.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, but when I found that out, I thought, you got to be kidding me. This is a prank call. But.
Mm.
Anyway, I'm so proud and so happy that I was awarded it. I really put a lot into that. And again, it's, I consider that an extension of Remember Them.
Oh, certainly.
The the reason they chose me, they, at least a lot of the judging panel, I would find out later, said that, you know, we saw what you were doing in Oakland, and we really wanted something like that, but reflective of Contraband Freeman. But also in this last year, that did not have any controversy associated with it. And again, another one I'm very proud of is the Harriet Tubman Thomas Garrett Memorial in Wilmington, Delaware. And that's another one that, you know, I really was able to get my mind wrapped around it. There's just this funny thing that happens. You know, there are projects you get because you have to do them and it's a job, and then there's the projects you get where your mind and body goes on automatic pilot on a different level that you can't explain. And that was one of them, where I started sculpting the models, and just, I went like 3 days in a row with very little sleep until I finally got what I wanted. Anyway.
That's awesome. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the other thing I'm working on that is really something close to me in different ways. Believe it or not, when you hear the title, you'll wonder why, but there are reasons for it, personal reasons. I'm working with the Golf Hall of Fame, the World Golf Hall of Fame, and we are creating a traveling exhibit and monument for a tribute to African Americans in golf. And I can't even tell you just the euphoria of being involved with that project. It doesn't feel like work. It's a dream come true project.
Yeah, why is that? Are you a golfer?
Well, you know, yes is the short answer. But I did not take up golf till much later in my life. I thought it was very elitist. I thought it was a waste of time. I didn't understand it until I was in my mid-40s when I first took it up. And then suddenly I would be exposed to this entire different world of history that I had never seen before, with all kinds of life lessons. And it sucked me into it in a way that is unexplainable. I can't even give you the proper words right now of why it's so important and how many people it will reach, for example, this traveling exhibit, to get people into it who normally have not been exposed to it.
Yeah, and so the World Golf Hall of Fame is in St. Augustine, Florida?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, wow, I hope it comes here. I think you probably...
The exhibit ultimately will come here.
Good.
And it's, you know, where I'm in the beginning stages of designing it. The models are all here. We are really, really excited. That's what I can tell you.
Well, it sounds like you're excited about all your projects.
They're like your kids.
Yeah, well, hey, it's a lot to be excited about. And then I noticed that, you know, you have curriculum that's available, you know, to accompany people who are teachers. Dr. Claiborne Carlson, you know, has been, I guess, collaborating with you to develop this this curriculum, and he's, like, phenomenal.
Well, it's a huge honor getting to know Clay. And talking hour upon hour with him when we started this project. And just the history he brings, he himself, person, Dr. Clay Carson. And then in addition to that, though, one of the things we've done is we along the way, engaged the Oakland school system to participate in creating part of the curriculum. That, you know, it's been a moving target, because you have to remember, when we started this project 12 and a half years ago, the, you know, communication system in the tech world was a little bit different back then. And so we've had to evolve with that. Mm-hmm. And along the way, we brought more people in, and, you know, to try to address the, you know, this isn't about names, dates, and places. This is about transformations that people can make in their lives,
mm-hmm.
just like these people on the monument. And, you know, we're excited because people are, classrooms are using it.
Mm-hmm.
I get letters all the time. I'm asked to speak at schools.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what we've done over these 12 years is I've always had an intern program that I targeted teens from the inner city.
Nice.
And, you know, we did the practice on them,
mm-hmm.
so that, you know, we knew what we were dealing with, and they knew what they could ultimately achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been a really good feel-good story, but we can't just leave it where it's at. This is an ongoing thing that can never stop.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
And it is my hope that, you know, the educational world and whoever drives it understands that it is creating, empowering youth to create is what will change their lives for the better. And I'm not saying everyone to become a sculptor or an illustrator. Creating is writing, creating is math, creating is sciences. And if we take away our arts, I think that's really the lead subject matter in realizing you can be a creator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my hope and what I kind of fight for constantly. And that's why we bring in the interns. You know, they never have to pay anything. I just, you know, we interview who's the most interested in doing this, and I take as many as I can take.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's excellent. I was reading that there is Remember Them educational monument that's on the spiraling axis, emulating the helix of the common DNA of all humans, and then you're working on something else around that particular premise.
Well, actually, the a lot of my work, that is the shape that I start with, including Remember Them. If you look at it,
mm-hmm.
you'll see that it is actually a helix.
Mm-hmm.
It's a broken helix. At one time it was one unit,
mm-hmm.
but I thought better people to be able to walk around it.
Right.
But the shape of a helix is exactly, it's your DNA, or anyone's DNA, is what, 99.99999% similar to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the symbol that, look, we all come from the life, same life force. Why are we separating and segregating each other so much? And that's kind of the reason why you see in so many of my works, including Contraband Freeman,
mm-hmm.
that it's done on the shape of the helix.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it looks nothing like Remember Them,
uh-huh.
but it evolves from the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So that's your signature.
It's kind of my signature. I don't do it in everything, but I try to tell a story whenever I can with that shape.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is really phenomenal. And you're a young man, so you've got a whole lot more art in you.
Young man, I'm already 52.
Oh, you are a young man. We live a long time nowadays. So you got,
well, as long as I can keep doing it, I'm always going to do it, and I have no idea how long this journey is going to last, but I'll keep following it as long as I can.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were speaking, you know, about the master Buddhist priest Thich Nhat Hanh, and you say, you know, he was born in 1926, and he looks like he's 38. You said, or something like that,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
because he's happy. And he's, you know, in himself, and so you're really happy, you know, and you're doing.
I'm very happy, but I can assure you I have stress.
Well, you must know how to meditate or something. You know, pull out some tools and carve it, carve something,
yeah.
Right?
Well, I will say this. I am so happy doing my work. I'm
mm-hmm.
happy to be an artist. I'm happy to help people whenever I can, but the reality is it does come at a price. And unfortunately, in those 12 years, it was not easy on my family. I mean, they paid a huge price, because in order for me to pull it off, I had to spend basically 12 hours a day here, almost every day, 6 and 7 days a week. And that was not easy. That was the only, this is probably the one area that is the hardest for me to reconcile with. I loved everything I've done on this project, but it was a very difficult thing to juggle.
So I guess at a certain point, you can't necessarily share, you know, like the actual work. It has to be something that you can do only. I guess you're the only one that can do it. Similar to like writers.
Yes, I think that's a fair assessment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a certain isolation. You know, and you think about, you know, these freedom fighters, you know, that you have depicted in this wonderful work. You think about Cesar Chavez, and you know how much time he spent away from his family, you know. And
well, it's funny that you say that, because along this 12 and a half year journey, I never thought that would become something I would seek in the reading about these people. And yet, at times it did become, because of my own family and having to be isolated away from them for long periods of time. And I tried to figure out, how did they deal with it? How did Abraham Lincoln deal with it? How did Cesar Chavez? How did Martin Luther King? And I had a tremendous conversation with Juanita Abernathy about this.
Oh, nice.
And Juanita Abernathy's husband, of course, is on the monument, David Abernathy.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to spend the night there in Atlanta and be with her and family. And she talked about that, and she said that they accepted it the way it was, but she said, I can assure you, not everyone who did the movement or fought for these causes accepted it as well as she did. Because she said she knew that, you know, he was doing something for a much bigger cause, and it wasn't about him. But I think she also is the same makeup. And you can't expect that out of everybody. But it is interesting, all of them, every one of them, with the exception of probably Ralph Abernathy and Juanita Abernathy, all had challenges in their families and marriages, because, you know, you basically, when you take this journey, you're no longer yourself. You're owned by other people. And in a symbolic and literal way, I hate to say it.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a sacrifice, you know, when, you know, a new book just came out early this year when Rosa Parks would have been 100 years old, and it's called The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. And in the book, Dr. Thea Harris, you know, she talks about how Rosa Parks and her family, they had to leave town. They had to go to Detroit, Michigan. She could no longer live, you know, where she was born and raised anymore after the bus boycott, because they got, you know, calls, you know, with threats, and they couldn't get a job and all the hate mail. And it was just a tremendous, and her husband, I think he had a heart attack, and, you know, she had to be hospitalized. I mean, it's like people who, you know, try to help us be better human beings in their work.
You're bringing up a hot topic, because, again, you could look at everyone on that monument. And they all had huge challenges with the people who were close to them. I mean, from Franklin Roosevelt, and I've been fortunate enough, I mentioned to you that, you know, I work with Juliana Roosevelt. And she's been very forthright about some of the stories, and what the media portrays and what really happened are two different things, but the family did suffer because they had their mission to do, and they kind of, there's a relinquishing, I think, when you read about all of them, that, you know, this is what I got to do, and it's for the betterment of others, and I'm just here on the journey to help facilitate. And all of them, Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill, at some point they all talk about that in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, there's another, it's a common thread.
Yes, mm-hmm. another common thread, exactly, and it didn't matter what part of the world you came from, it's the...
Mm-hmm.
It's a cold, hard fact. Not too many on there with
mm-hmm.
what you would call happy marriages or marriages at all in
mm-hmm.
some of the cases.
Yeah, yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, they were totally true public, they are true public servants.
Yeah, yes, and not, exactly, and not elected, so to speak.
No.
But from a much higher source or,
mm-hmm.
or power.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. And you are certainly called, you know, to you know, this service, you know, using art to bring to life, you know, these lives and these spirits. And just think, wow, Oakland is such a great place to have this work, you know, where people can go. And if they're, you know, people don't even have to be sighted. I mean, because you have, they could, you know, people that are, you know, don't see, they can feel the actual images, you know, with their hands. And I think there's Braille there as well. People can read.
Oh, yeah, for the
visually impaired. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you saying that. I should say, for sure, I do feel some kind of higher force is pushing me, because honestly, I don't know how I've gotten through some of this. But I happen to also believe everybody has some kind of calling. They just have to listen for it,
mm-hmm.
and you know, put aside all the material things for a brief time and say, well, why am I here? What is it I love? And you know, how do I relate to people?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all these things, you start to think about them when you're alone and it's, you know, 12:30 at night and you're sculpting the head of Abraham Lincoln and you're wondering, you know, what would he have said or what would he have done in this time? Or Chief Joseph, you know, how would the world have perceived him in this day and age? And you all kinds of stuff goes into your head, believe me, and you know, and it's almost surreal sometimes. And I think it is part of the creative process, especially when you get closer and closer to this unexplainable feeling that your hands start to work on their own, things that you could not create before, that you spent months on, you suddenly materialize in minutes. It's a reminder to me that there's something more than just, you know, computers and cell phones and iPads, that there really is something divine here,
mm-hmm.
and that we are all related and connected to that divinity. We just have to see it,
mm-hmm.
and probably the biggest gift of the universe is if you really, really think about it, and this is coming from me, and people can believe what they want, but we really are free to choose whatever we want to do, in spite of all these man-made obstacles and prejudices. We can do whatever we want, and that's the biggest gift to all of us. That, you know, it may not be fair,
mm-hmm.
the circumstances you're in, but if you want to pursue something, you can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I pursued what was my natural impulse, and that's art.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And a lot of times, with our children in particular, they might not know what's available when they decide to choose one direction or one path over another. So with this wonderful exhibit, you know, this wonderful sculpture, you know, that's in the public space, which means it's always accessible. You don't have to pay. You don't have to wait for the doors to open.
Right.
People
right.
can just go and meditate and contemplate these various beings, you know. I mean, it took you 12 years, you know, to finish it. You know, it could take a person a lifetime to just try to understand and unpack, you know, the spirits that are depicted there. And so a young person could, you know, they might know a name, but then just to go and sit and meditate on, you know, an icon, just go, like, you know, I just sort of started thinking about what would this person do in my circumstances? What choice would they make? And then, you know, choose the better path as opposed to the easier path.
Well, there's so much to and it's excellent what you are bringing up, because there's so much to be learned by these people.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we learn by making mistakes, but, you know, they all made mistakes to get where they, you know, to their achievements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we don't have to make the same ones.
You don't have to make the same ones, and I think one of the another common thread among all of them with this regard is that they all took responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't blame someone else for something. They took action, and I think that's an important piece to this also.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That everybody has that ability. I think that goes hand in hand with this. What I was talking about earlier about freedom being our greatest gift, but understanding, you know, there's the freedom of the universe, and then there's the freedom that I call the man-made freedom that I think is not really free.
Mm-hmm.
And
it expires.
Yes. You know, I mean, without getting into too much on it, but really, you know, people need the right to choose how they want to live, and as long as they're not hurting anybody else. And there are still issues with that in this day and age.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, deep down, if you go to a higher thinking, you realize, you know, I am really free to choose. So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I won't batter that any longer.
Yeah, well, this has been such a lovely conversation. And I was wondering, is it a surprise who you're expecting to be in town for the on the 31st at 3 at the Henry J. Kaiser Memorial Park, 19th and Rashida Muhammad Streets, or can you tell me who you're expecting?
Well, I can tell you some of the people.
Okay.
Some of them could be surprised, but
okay.
Ruby Bridges will be there. She will be a keynote speaker.
Oh, nice. She's coming back. Super.
Oh, yes. And she's just such a tremendous speaker, and again, living history.
Mm-hmm.
Juliana Roosevelt will be speaking.
Oh, nice.
Ambassador Shabazz, who is Malcolm X's oldest daughter,
mm-hmm.
will be giving a speech, which I'm very touched that mm-hmm. she's coming, because she currently, they are burying their nephew who was just assassinated.
Yeah, it's really sad.
I was on the phone with them early this morning, and she said, no, she goes, in spite of this, she goes, I really want to be there, because Malcolm X is part of Section 4.
Mm-hmm.
And she really wants to say a few words about that, which is, I'm deeply touched by that. And there are others who are coming that I won't mention the names because we're not totally positive. I will say Oscar Schindler's niece is going to be there, Rosemary Schindler.
Nice.
Which is, you know, the niece of Oscar Schindler, who is on the monument.
Mm-hmm.
And the president of the Golf Hall of Fame, representing the tribute to African Americans in golf, is going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is a great honor to have him. There'll be different politicians there. The Oakland Fire Department and the Oakland Police Department are going to be doing a special ceremony that will be very moving when we ring the bell in for the final champions.
Mm-hmm.
It's really exciting. The local champions, family relatives will all be there.
Oh, that's great.
And they'll all say a few words as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be quite a bit of media from what I understand. And,
mm-hmm.
and we're just really, really honored, proud, and excited to be doing this in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
In a place that really deserves it and needs it. And it's a place where it made me who I am. And I've been very fortunate to be part of this environment.
Wow, yeah. Well, we're happy that you're here, too.
Thank you. You're so kind.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you so much. It's been such a wonderful conversation. And I'm going to stop taping right now if I want to ask you something.